I have a message from another time. Aerie Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect Symphony of the Sword No. 2 Overture in E by Benjamin D. Hutchins, that's me, and Dan Cross with Chris Overstreet. Saturday, January 7th, 2406, Hannibal Hamlin Hall, Diedlitz Satori Mandeville Memorial Institute, Gerardo, Republic of Bajor. Clarissa Broadbank was in a bit of a huff. It wasn't often that one of her confederates disappeared during a vacation, but this time it had happened, and she now had to explain to everyone and their duck that Vigdis Brightblade wouldn't be coming back to school for the spring semester. Yes, she came to spend Christmas break at my house in New Avalon. No, we didn't have a fight. Yes, as far as I know, she's fine. She just had to go back to her homeworld for some reason. Family business. She didn't tell me. Yes, very abruptly. I don't know, damn it. She didn't say to expect her back. When did it become my job to keep track of her? No, I did not kill her and hide her body on the estate. She sighed irritably, answered the 11th such email since her return, and fell back onto her bed, glaring at the ceiling. The whole thing smelled wrong. Vigdis had gone to deliver Clarissa's father's letter to her sister Liza, who was staying across town with the hated Hutchins Morgan clan, and the next thing Clarissa knew she was telephoning, sounding very shaken up, to say that she had to return home immediately on family business. Thank you for your hospitality. I don't think I'll be back to DSM. I've really enjoyed knowing you. Bye now. Not that Clarissa was upset about losing a friend, since she couldn't really be said to have them. Nor was she particularly concerned about the apparent crisis that had called Vigdis home, or the shaken tone in the girl's voice as she called to make her apologies. Nor, for that matter, had she been particularly curious about the mysterious woman, very tall, brown hair, beautiful, but, in Clarissa's opinion, rather stupid-looking, who had come to the house to collect Vigdis's things for her that afternoon. No, Clarissa was bothered by none of those factors. She was irritated at having to explain the damn thing to everybody, but more than that, she was annoyed at the thought that her old nemesis, the Hutchins Morgan family, had something to do with it. In addition to the fact that Vigdis's errand was to their house, they were connected with Professor Skuld Ravenhair, visiting instructor in the physical sciences, and Vigdis had also had a connection to the professor. What was more likely than that the professor had been here, at the hated house on Morgan Lane? Had Ravenhair pulled some strings and had Vigdis called home solely because she had made friends with Clarissa? That bunch were petty enough for such a maneuver, certainly. However it happened, Clarissa had just lost a naive, impulsive, easily manipulated ally. Worse, Vigdis had disappeared before Clarissa could bring her silly crush on Caitlin Hutchins's half-brother Corbin, Professor Ravenhair's son, no less, to a boil and cause the hoped-for ugly scene with Caitlin's roommate, the infuriating Utina Tenjo, who happened to be Corbin's girlfriend. Clarissa had been expecting that, sometime after Christmas break, she would be able to goad Vigdis into seeking Tenjo out and causing a ruckus, perhaps even drawing her into a fight. That would almost certainly get Vigdis suspended or expelled, of course, but it would also smear the Duelists' Society, and possibly get Tenjo, their precious vice president, expelled or suspended as well. It would have been a good trade, but either the other side had anticipated the move and removed Clarissa's pawn from the board, or simple bad luck had caught up with her. Either way, the plan was ruined, and now she would have to think of another one. She sighed again. Why were people so damned inconsiderate? One floor down, Jacron had just finished unpacking from his trip home when the dorm room door slammed open. Through the door staggered a heavily laden Mac McKenzie, an enormous bag slung over one shoulder, and a small travel bag clenched in two fingers of one hand. With a grunt, Mac dropped the sack to the floor, tossed his travel bag onto his bed, and smiled. "Happy New Year, Jacron."
"And to you, my good Mackenzie," Jacron smiled. "How was your Christmas celebration?"
Mac smirked one of his trademark half smiles and said, "I didn't have one." Jacron stared at Mac, then pointed to the sack.
"That doesn't make sense. You obviously celebrate the occasion, considering the volume of gifts you've brought back."
"Those are gifts I'm giving out to other people," Mac said. "I spent Christmas Day alone in orbit over Fornax, watching the fire ring's light reflect off the dark side of the planet." Mac's half-smile grew into a grin as he added, "It was the best Christmas I've ever had. Flying from here to Fornax, and then back again, hauling DSM students to and from their homes for their own Christmas. Working all break, and I get to keep the money this time."
"Keep the money?"
"Always a sound business plan if you can manage it," Beld Marmo said, stepping in around Mac's bundle of presents. "Welcome back, Mackenzie. I take it your break was pleasant."
"Bliss," Mac said. "No freight runs, no father leaning on me to take over the family ship. Nothing but myself, my own ship, and open space."
But this makes no sense," Jacron blustered. "Christmas is supposed to be a time when human families gather together to exchange presents and expressions of love. And you spent this holiday off alone? By yourself?"
"That is what alone means, Jacron," Beld muttered under his breath.
"No friends or family, off by yourself at the farthest edge of the outer rim? Why, this is an absolute..."
Jacron's eyes tried to cross as he glared at the small, brightly wrapped package Mac had just stuffed partway into his mouth.
"Merry Christmas, Jacron," Mac said with a smile.
After a moment's further digging, he pulled out another package for Beld before picking the sack up again. "I'll be back later. Deliveries to make. Then you can tell me all about your vacations." With that, Mac stepped out of the door, leaving Jacron to remove the package from his mouth and unwrap it, to reveal a pair of rainbow-colored toe socks.
"I wonder," Beld said quietly, "if this is how the Earther expression, 'put a sock in it,' was fashioned."
"Hmm," Jacron noted with a frown. "The number of toes is wrong anyway. My dear Marmo, it occurs to me that something must be done about Mac's total lack of a social life."
Beld shrugged broadly, throwing his hands up in helplessness.
"What can be done?" he said. "Besides, it isn't as if you have any better social life than he does, the baseball team aside." "Yes, but I'm a narn," Jacron said. "I'm supposed to be grumpy, rude, and socially unacceptable. It's in our constitution," he added with a smirk, watching with satisfaction as Beld fell onto his bed laughing.
The duelist's castle, over at the far corner of campus on its hill, didn't really have a bustle of returning students about it like the regular residence halls did. Most of the residents of the castle had only gone away for a few days at Christmas to attend Caitlin's parents' party at their vacation home on Titan. The rest had gone on to New Avalon for that city's famed New Year celebrations, but had returned midweek. The only castle dweller who had been away for the whole period was Mia Ausa, who had, upon returning from Titan, gone almost immediately to Babylon 5. There she spent the remaining downtime with her father, now posted there by Network 23. So it was into a fairly normal Saturday afternoon routine, with people just returning from an impromptu hockey game down on the frozen surface of Lake Jaradar, that Mac Mackenzie hauled his bag of treats and started doling them out. He had something for everyone, even Corwin and his companion Nall Silverclaw, who were not castle residents or even DSM students, but who could be counted upon to be present most any weekend. Even Peril, Dorothy Wainwright's pet cat. Thus he looked slightly consternated when introduced to Caitlin's new pet, Sergei, who, as a 6-month-old Neo-Siberian tiger, was even now rather more impressive than your average cat. Not because Serge was a tiger. Mac wasn't afraid of cats, whatever their ultimate size. No, upon introduction to this newest castle dweller, Mac looked into his bag, then looked back at the tiger and said, "Tell you what, I'll bring yours next trip." Serge seemed to weigh this for a moment, then he butted Mac's leg with his head and said, "Okay, good," Mac replied, absently scratching the tiger's ears before moving on to his next beneficiary. As he played Santa and told the duelists about his working vacation, the quiet freespacer was being downright gregarious, until the tall, blonde form of Liza Schustal came down from her room to see what preparations were being made for dinner. As soon as she entered the library, Mac stopped talking, became, in fact, more or less unable to talk. A few of the more inquisitive, perceptive duelists, including Mia and the Scrang, Skaya, had noticed this curious symptom overtaking Mackenzie each time he'd found himself in Liza's presence since her return from being missing last Thanksgiving. It amused and concerned them in about equal measures. Now Azalindvir Natashkin, once Liza's mortal enemy and now her lover, hid a smile behind her hand so as not to embarrass Mac further, as he tried several times to address Liza before finally, with a sound of frustration, writing her a note asking to speak with her privately. Liza, a bit puzzled but ever polite, nodded and followed him into the empty dining room. There, Mac delved into his now mostly depleted sack and handed her a large package accompanied by a card. She opened the card and was startled to discover that its interior was completely covered by tiny but quite legible handwriting. "Captain Governor Schustal, I anticipated that I would not be able to vocalize my feelings toward you, even after the winter holiday, and decided instead to attempt to express myself on paper. Please forgive the formal and impersonal nature of this document, but I have not found any better means of communicating with you my sincere regret for what has passed between us in the past. On 3 separate occasions, through the assistance of your dormitory's RAs and certain factors of my upbringing, I have violated your privacy for the purpose of exacting petty vengeance for your actions against certain individuals of our mutual acquaintance. In light of your subsequent reformation and the greater understanding of your former life which has been made available to me, I am now ashamed of these actions and express my deepest regret for them. I most humbly apologize for the harm I have inflicted upon yourself, your dignity, and your well-being. I considered various methods by which I could express in deeds my regret for my past crimes. At first I contemplated striking anonymously against those who have wronged you, but I gave this up after discovering that Clarissa Broadbank practices much greater security than you did, and that the Aztechnology complex in New Avalon is guarded better than most planetary capitals. To my shame, I did not realize until after I ceased serious consideration of such actions that they would, in reality, only be compounding the wrongs I have committed. Therefore, over the holidays, I have asked one of my very few remaining friends on Earth to secure an item from the now-closed WPI campus. This item, although presented as a Christmas gift, is in reality your own property, the only thing which I have taken from you that may be restored by mortal hands. Please accept it as earnest for my repentance of past deeds against you. I wish you the greatest happiness and prosperity in your new life, and am forever at your service. Your obedient servant, Harcourt Mudd Mackenzie." Liza read the card slowly and carefully, reread it once more quickly, then closed it up and put it in its envelope again. Carefully, she tore the wrapping paper, and then laughed as the maroon and silver flag of the Worcester Preparatory Institute slithered out, still emblazoned above and below the school's crest with an expensive set of female undergarments which had been carefully stitched in place. She'd always wondered who had done that. The top suspect, though, had been Devlin Carter, whom Liza's intelligence sources had indicated, with some degree of credibility, was an accomplished sneak thief. she'd never have considered quiet, forgettable Mackenzie a viable suspect. In the back of her mind, she wondered what the other two incidents he spoke of in the card were. A couple of possibilities came to mind, and a slow smile spread across her face as she narrowed the list. Then, knowing that he expected some sort of response, she weighed her options carefully. If she remained silent too long, this sensitive young man would assume that she was mortally offended and never wanted to speak to him again, and he'd slink away in a depression. She didn't want that. She actually thought it was quite sweet of him to come forward this way. And anyway, in a very real sense, his acts of semi-terrorism had been directed at another person, not Liza Shustal, the scourge of Vestak Nor. On the other hand, if she got silly, he'd freeze up even worse, stammer, stutter, never be able to say a thing for fear of saying the wrong thing. So instead, she very carefully folded the flag, put it and the card under her arm, and told him, "Apology accepted, Midshipman Mackenzie. Thanks for the memento of old times." She grinned. "Don't be offended if I don't choose it as the national flag of Jezebel, though." Mac blinked, opened his mouth, said nothing, closed it, opened it again. Liza chuckled, reached out, and shut it again with a fingertip under his chin. "Please, Mackenzie, don't worry about these things so much. I'm just a girl, not a hyperspace vortex." Mac shook his head vigorously, but he didn't seem to have his powers of speech back yet. He took out the notepad he'd used for the original note and wrote on it for a moment, then handed it to her. Liza looked at the inscription and laughed lightly. Scrawled across the top sheet in bold letters with a large exclamation point, underlined several times, was the word, "Woman." "If you insist," Liza replied with a sly smile, handing him back the pad. "Anyway," she added seriously, "thank you, really, for the apology and the flag. It's meant a lot to me that everyone has been able to put aside the things I did and accept the new me. I hope when my resort opens this summer you'll be able to come to the grand opening." Mac swallowed, knowing this required an answer, and managed to say, "Why, wouldn't miss it." Liza smiled. "Good." Then she leaned over and gave him a friendly little kiss, nothing too dramatic, and added, "Merry belated Christmas, Mr. Mackenzie." When Mac and Liza returned from the dining room, the other duelists noticed that the freespacer was looking a trifle pink and had regained his powers of speech. They reacted with more or less obvious amusement according to their temperament, and when Mac left the castle, his bag of gifts empty, there was a certain lightness to his step that had been absent. On Sunday, with the resumption of classes looming both at DSM and Koopman High, Corwin Ravenhair and Nall prepared to take their leave and head back to New Avalon. Normally, when Corwin left after one of his regular weekend visits, Utina went with him as far as his car. They said their goodbyes beside it, and then she walked back up the hill to the castle, and he drove down around the lake to Port Geradar. Today, though, she went with him all the way to the ramp of the One-Hit Wonder. Nall said his goodbye, got his scruffling, and went aboard, leaving the two humans alone. They didn't say much for a minute, just stood there with both hands linked and arms relaxed, looking at each other, until Utina spoke a single quiet word. "Thanks." She didn't have to go into detail about what for, which was just as well, since it would have taken her an inconveniently long time. "You're welcome," Corwin replied, smiling. "Thank you." It was their first real parting since their trip to the Hotel Monolith, and after all that had changed and all that had not in the wake of that fateful night, they weren't really sure how to go about it. They looked a bit awkwardly at each other for a few moments. Then Corwin chuckled, scratching sheepishly at the back of his head, and the tableau was broken. Utina laughed too, put a hand on his chest, and pushed him jokingly away a little. "Good luck with week one," said Corwin. "Yeah, you too." Then, hastily, she said, "Listen, I've been thinking." "Yeah?" he asked, attentive. You know that Asgardian ceremony that you and Kate did years ago?" "Word binding?" "Yeah." "I've been thinking, if you wouldn't mind, maybe we should do that." Corwin stared at her in amazement for a couple of seconds, then grinned and said, "Mind? Of course I wouldn't mind. Didn't I tell you on any terms you'll have me?" Then he sobered and added, before she could speak again, "Only, you'd better be sure you really understand how it works. It's a blood tie, not easy to get out of if you decide later on it was a mistake." Utna shook her head, replying, "No, I understand. Your Aunt Erd explained it to me a while back. I was thinking about asking you last fall, after everything we went through over the summer, but I never got around to it. And after my birthday, I think it's important." She rubbed her right thumb over the little scar on her left ring finger and added, "You know how important symbols have been in my life? Well, after everything, I think it's important that we have a symbol of what we mean to each other. Like you said, everything but, right?" Corwin thought that over, then nodded. "Right. You're right. Besides, you and Kate are as close as sisters anyway. Closer than some," he added, thinking of the divided Broadbanks. "It makes sense. And it's an honor." He grinned. "Will this disqualify me from being best man at your wedding?" Utna grinned back and hit him on the shoulder. "If you're a god by the time we're back together," she told him, "you can perform my wedding." "Say, that's a thought," he replied, and there was not a trace of bitterness in him as he said it. "Anyway, I'll talk to Aunt Belle when I get home about setting up a word binding for us. She'll insist on officiating," he added, grinning. "Keep your calendar fluid. It might take a few weeks to set up." Utna nodded. "I'll be here," she said, smiling. The silence descended again for a few moments. Then she hugged him hard, kissed him gently, and told him, "See you next weekend, Corwin. Clear skies." He'd said it to her in Old Norse many times, secure in the knowledge that she wouldn't understand him. But now that it was all in the open, he no longer felt any bashfulness about saying it in plain standard, so he kissed her on the forehead and replied, "Walk in glory, my beloved." Then he turned around, went up into the body of his ship, and turned around to wave goodbye with a grin as the ramp closed behind him. Term C-06 went down in the amalgamated history of DSM and its predecessor, WPI, as the quietest C-term on record. C-term was historically a bad time to be a WPI student. For some reason, it seemed that all the weird crises, personal problems, deaths in the family, academic self-destructions, and other angst-riddled happenings that could afflict a WPI student happened in C-term. This had been the case back in the days when the P stood for Polytechnic, and it had been true at the Preparatory Institute as well. Of course, it wasn't really true. The phenomenon was at least half legend and a quarter observed coincidence. But the legend pervaded WPI's corporate culture anyway, and some said its expectation alone was responsible for more than half the misfortunes C-term brought. Hell, it hadn't been true the previous year. Last year's D-term had been the term to end all C-terms. There were whisperings, though, that the move to Gerardo, the Institute's rebirth as Satori Mandeville Memorial, had broken the curse. At DSM this winter, nobody's uncle died, nobody freaked out, nobody got whacked up on illegal drugs or flawed black market SimSense modules and had to go to the hospital. The hockey team went 0-4 in January, bringing their total record since the start of the season to 1-6-2, but aside from that and an overall snowier-than-usual winter, according to Prilar Otano and his monks who had been living in this area for quite some time, Everything went very smoothly that first sea term on Jurado. At least until the end of January.
"Have you seen this?"
an indignant voice demanded, cutting into B'Elanna Torres's concentration. She blinked, her place in the day's assigned study unit for introductory German lost, and looked up from her book. Jacron of Narn was standing next to the little table in the student center's common area where B'Elanna had come to study before dinner, holding a sheaf of paper. Just for a second, the half-Klingon girl was tempted to reply, "I have now," knowing that the literality would give Jacron, who often wrestled with the standard language's curious habits regarding metaphors, pause. She decided against it, though. If she sidetracked the Narn into a sub-rant about the peculiarities of standard, he might keep her here all day. Instead, she sighed for her lost place and said, "Seen what?"
"This," Jacron replied, slapping the paper down in front of her.
B'Elanna had time to scan the masthead and note that it was Volume 2, Number 5, the January 30th, 2406 issue, of the Institute Hill Beacon, The Balanced Perspective on Campus Life. She didn't have a chance to read the headline, though, because before her eyes had traveled down the page that far, Jacron had snatched it back and begun to read from it.
"Ferocious Beast in Waiting,"
he read, loudly and bombastically, as befit a large headline. Then, his tone perfectly indicating a subhead, he went on,
"Administration indifferent to the danger. An expert's opinion."
B'Elanna had to hand it to him. He knew how to read things aloud so that they got your attention. She put down her pen, leaned back in her chair, and listened.
"Since the start of term C-06, Jacron went on, "this campus has been home to more than just the students and faculty of our great institution, and the selected harmless pets of some students. Since January 8th, it has also been home to a creature which, though harmless seeming now, will one day soon pose a manifest danger to the lives and safety of all of us. This creature is, of course, the so-called Neo-Tiger, which has lately resided in the castle, home also to our illustrious Duelist Society. It seems that, no longer content merely to risk their own lives in their ill-assorted mock combats, the duelists have found it sporting to risk the lives of all the denizens of our fine institute in a potentially fatal game of random chance."
B'Elanna blinked. "Do, huh?" she said. Jacron waved a hand impatiently.
"Oh, wait, it gets better," he assured her. "Neocats were developed in the 22nd century by the Wedge Defense Force's notoriously unreliable Life Sciences Division. Creators of such other ill-advised creatures as the Project Cretaceous Neosaurs, including the extremely lethal Dilophosaur, and the infamous Romero Imps, which devastated part of the city of New Avalon in 2392. The LSD claims that Neocats are perfectly safe companion animals, their hunting and killing instincts bred out in favor of a love of play and sentient companionship. Other more reputable scientists, however, dispute these claims. Despite what the Wedge Defense Force's engineers claim, you simply cannot remove the predatory instincts from the great cats, says Dr. Zbigniew Frotzblatt of AS Technologies Biotech Research Division. It's not like swapping engines in a car. The Neocat experiment has been proven time and again to be a frivolous failure. Dr. Frotzblatt went on to cite three separate incidents in which a humanoid life form was maimed by a Neocat, in one case to death.
B'Elanna snorted. Three. In 200 years of Neocats.
I've done some research, said Jacron, nodding. Two of the incidents involved Neocats protecting humans. The third was a clear case of self-defense. But you haven't heard the best part yet. This, then, is what the administration has allowed the duelists to bring into our midst. A male Neo-Siberian tiger, which will, when mature, weigh somewhere between 500 and 800 standard pounds, with commensurate strength.
Points for using commensurate, B'Elanna noted.
Indeed,
Jacron replied absently, nodding.
Equipped with razor-sharp claws, bone-crushing fang jaws, and a taste for flesh, this animal is one of Old Earth's most perfect non-aquatic killing machines, and more than a match for all but the most exotic members of our diverse student body. By buying into the Neocat's creator's extremely suspect claims of safety, President Tiefeld's administration has placed us all at risk. We call upon President Tiefeld to review his administration's decision in this matter, taking into account the unbiased scientific opinions of men like Dr. Frotzblatt and his peers, and take steps to remove this threat from our midst before it grows large enough to pose the full danger of which it is capable.
Ugly sentence, Billana put in. Jacron nodded, too busy to comment in words, and continued, his voice rising to a higher pitch of indignation.
In the meantime, we urge all students to take common-sense precautions. Do not travel the campus alone, especially at night. Tigers prefer to hunt in darkness. If you can legally go armed, do so. And if you see the animal roaming unsupervised, do the smart thing. Do not approach it, and contact the campus police immediately. More lives than your own may depend on it.
The Narn slammed the paper down on the table, rattling the silverware on the empty plate which had held Bilana's pre-study session slice of banana cream pie.
I cannot believe that this young lady has nothing more worthwhile to do with her time than write and publish this drivel. That she has no greater ambition in life than to harass a blameless young woman and her equally blameless companion animal. And that ridiculous assertion about the Life Sciences Division, why, if it were not for the efforts of the Wedge Defense Force, no one would have the opportunity to appreciate these mighty beasts in humane and safe conditions. How dare she impugn the work of such dedicated and brilliant scientists? The Neocat Project is a favor to all sentient kind, just as was Project Cretaceous. The scientific and historical value of that effort alone is worth... Ah!
The Narn threw up his hands, shaking his head.
I'm speechless. I really am. I am just dumbstruck by the sheer, petty-minded, calumnious, personally biased idiocy of the whole affair.
He thumped the newspaper with a thick finger.
I'll take this to the Student Ethics Board, see if I don't,
he announced, nodding his head vigorously.
Using a student publication to make such a grotesquely transparent personal attack upon...
A hand came down on Jacron's shoulder then, and a calm, smooth voice inquired, Hey, what's all the shouting about over here? Beld Marmo craned to look over Jacron's other shoulder, then nodded. Ah, seen today's beacon, eh? Well, don't sweat it too much until you read tomorrow's Intelligencer, the Centauri said with an easy grin.
What?
Jacron turned his head, gave his roommate a suspicious look, and said, Marmo,
do you know something I don't?
Beld's grin widened. I know lots of stuff you don't, Spots, he replied. Then he clapped Jacron on the shoulder and ambled off, saying over his shoulder, See you at dinner. Torres, you've conjugated Laufen wrong. Bellana blinked, looked down at her paper, said, Huh, and reached for her eraser. Jacron stared off after the Centauri for a moment, then shook his head, picked up his paper, and walked off in the other direction, grumbling. The next day, the front page of the Institute Intelligencer was taken up by a long, erudite, well-researched, and meticulously bibliographed article by Professor Arne Schwelling of the Nokomi Institute of Technology. In this article, Professor Schwelling rebutted the Beacon's article's scientific claims, provided full details and documentation on the three incidents cited by Dr. Frotzblatt, and explained in clear, easy-to-understand language exactly why the Neocat process worked the way it did, and therefore why the student body of the Institute was in no danger. In fact, he opined, they were somewhat better protected than before, with a Neo-Tiger around who considered the place his turf. Below that, just to add insult to injury, was a pie chart showing the results of a quite unscientific all-students poll conducted by the Intelligencer the previous evening and calculated just before the press deadline. It showed that, to the question, "What do you think about the school's resident Neo-Tiger?" 90% of the school populace responded, "Aww," while only 1% selected, "It's a vicious, dangerous animal, and I'm considering leaving the school if something isn't done about it." Liza Shostal, rereading the Beacon article at breakfast that morning, tisked and tossed the paper into the large trash bin next to the sink. "It's such a shame about the Beacon," she observed. "I mean, it's always been a rag, but at least their last editor could write." "I hear she was better looking, too," noted Azalin impishly. Liza grinned. "That's the rumor going around," she replied. "Get a room, you guys," Utena Tenjo mock groused as she put down a platter of pancakes. "We've got one," Azalin said, "but we have to come out sometime or we'd flunk out. Are these blueberry?"
"Yep."
"Yay!" Azalin shoveled a couple onto her plate, buttered them, added syrup, and added before digging in, "You make the best blueberry pancakes in the universe, Utena."
"Don't let Mrs. Murasato hear you say that," said Miki Kaworu cheerily. "Morning, everyone."
"Morning, Miki," said the chorus around the table.
"Grumph,"
added Serge from the depths of his food bowl. "Here," said Bilana, handing him a copy of the Morning Intelligencer. "Start your day off right." Miki took it, sat down, skimmed the front page, and smiled. "Leave it to Marmo," he said. "Huh?" said Utena as she sat down to her own breakfast. "What do you mean?" "Oh, he's obviously behind this," said Azalin. "The paper's assistant editor is his boyfriend's roommate." Utena cocked an eyebrow. "Marmo has a boyfriend?" "Mm-hmm," said Miki, nodding. "Isn't he a Centauri?"
"Yes."
"How does that work?" Miki paused, looked across the table at her, and said gravely, "I try not to get too involved in considering such matters." "Excuse me, O worldly upperclassman," said Bilana sardonically. "Tender-eared freshman over here who just covered Centauri reproduction in health class."
"Relax, Bilana," said Miki mildly. "We're done."
"Yeah, but so is the damage," Bilana replied, then shivered theatrically. "Yeek!"
Now, Bilana," Mia Ausa chided her roommate gently. "Valen teaches us that tolerance is the greatest of virtues, even if not all of us learn it," she added in a wry undertone.
"I am tolerant," Bilana protested. "I'm not trying to stop them or anything, just yeek."
Mia considered this, then nodded.
"I suppose that's fair," she mused.